Okay, I'd like to call the House Resources Committee meeting to order today. It is March 15th, 2024. We are in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Mears, Representative McCabe, Representative Sadler, Representative Baker, and myself, Chair Tom McKay. We have a quorum to do business, and now we have Representative Dybert is here. Welcome, Representative Dybert. And now I forgot where I was. No. It is Friday, right? Okay. I want to thank the staff, Justin, Zach, and Trevor, and Isabel. Isabel's here. For helping us run the meeting today, and I remind everyone to please put your cell phones on silent. So we have one item on today's agenda, a presentation by Mr. Brad Keithley. The main topic is South Central Gas Supply. And Mr. Keithley is the, maybe you should come forward, Brad. And I'd like to introduce Brad and thank him for being here today. He's the Managing Director of Alaskans for Sustainable Budgets. And before starting that project in 2013, he was a partner in the Anchorage office of the law firm Perkins Coie. And before that, with international law firm Jones Day, where he specialized in oil and gas law. He represented Chevron and its predecessor Union Oil on Cook Inlet gas issues from 2000 until the time the properties were sold to Hilcorp in 2011. Also, before joining Jones Day, Mr. Keithley was Senior Vice President and General Counsel of ARCLA, Incorporated, at the time the third largest integrated gas company in the United States. So I think we're very privileged today to have Brad with us, and we'll go through his slides. It's not a real long presentation, and we'll probably pause after each slide for questions. And Representative Wright has joined us. Thank you, Representative Wright. And so without further ado, we will turn the presentation over to Mr. Keithley. And Brad, if you would introduce yourself, state your name and your affiliation, and then begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brad Keithley. I am currently the Managing Director of Alaskans for Sustainable Budgets, a project, and I am appearing here today on my own behalf. I paid for my own way to be here. Sometimes people ask who paid your way as a way of figuring out what side you're on, but I paid for my own way. I appreciate being invited to present my perspective on the current issues facing Cook Inlet Gas, and I appreciate this committee's openness to hearing a variety of views. As background for those who don't know me, as the chairman mentioned, I was previously Senior Vice President and General Counsel of ARCLA Gas, at the time the third largest integrated gas company in the U.S. And integrated means we had a production arm, pipeline arm, and a distribution arm. We had all three phases in one company. And at the time, as I say, we were the third largest company of that type in the U.S. I have 35 years experience as an oil and gas lawyer, much of it spent dealing with various natural gas market issues, both in the lower 48 and up here. It's somewhat ironic that my career started working in the interstate natural gas industry in the 1970s on natural gas shortage issues. Some of you may remember that we had substantial shortages in the 1970s in the U.S. in the lower 48, and that's where I started my career. So it's a little ironic to be talking about shortages here several years later. I have 11 years direct experience in dealing with Cook Inlet Gas. I represented Unocal, and after they were acquired by Chevron from 2000 through 2011, when they sold their assets to Hilcorp, I represented them on both commercial matters, contracts, gas contracts, as well as on regulatory matters before the Public Utilities Commission. Currently, I'm the Managing Director of Alaskans for Sustainable Budgets, a project that's focused on developing and advocating for economically robust and durable state fiscal policies. But I'm here today not representing anybody, just to talk about the experiences I've had and what I think how I think they're applicable to the Cook Inlet. my perspective built on that experience is that we should let the market decide what the best option is, what the best alternative for Cook Inlet gas. To me, the market is saying, and I have 4 points. I'll explain these points in greater detail. I'll touch on them here, and then the slides that follow go into each in greater detail. To me, the market is saying that the current price of gas in the Cook Inlet is too low to elicit the needed supplies. It's not that we have a supply shortage. It's that we have a market shortage, much the same as we had in the lower 48 in the 1970s. There were supplies of gas there, but there was a cap on the price and didn't allow the market to pay the price that was necessary to elicit the additional supplies. Frankly, I think that's what we've got going on here. Second, my position is we should resolve the Cook Inlet situation without subsidies. The Cook Inlet gas issue should be resolved through the approach that has the lowest overall cost to all Alaskans. A point I'll come back to later is that subsidies don't eliminate costs. They only shift those costs to someone else. The overall cost to all Alaskans is the cost to the purchaser plus the cost of the subsidy. And in looking at solutions, we ought to be looking at that overall cost, not just an artificial cost that's created by piling subsidies on top of it. We ought to look at the combination of the cost plus the subsidies. My third issue is what is the lowest cost? And I think this committee and I think the state's fortunate in that we have a fairly good assessment of the overall economics in the Alaska Utilities Working Group Phase 1 assessment. The Cook Inlet Gas Supply Project, the project that was referred to by John Sims when he was here talking to the committee and has been referred to by others. I think that gives a very good baseline for how the committee, for the costs that we're looking at and frankly how the state ought to be looking at filling the supply. That study suggests to me that one of the LNG import options is the lowest overall cost of supply, and I'll explain why. As I step through the presentation. And finally, a point that's near and dear to my heart, those of you who are familiar with me know that I talk a lot about PFDs and who pays and that sort of stuff. If the state does use subsidies, it should identify who is paying the subsidy and then mitigate the impacts of that decision on the group that ends up paying the subsidy. Again, subsidies aren't free. Somebody's paying them. And we ought to take that into account both in terms of the overall cost and in terms of how we structure a solution so that the persons paying the subsidies are in somehow recognized. My first point, the market is not saying that there's a physical shortage of gas. This slide I have up is a slide from the Cook Inlet Utilities Assessment, the Alaska Utilities Working Group Phase 1 Assessment, the one that John Sims talked about when he was here. And this slide shows, over time, Cook Inlet supplies. It shows a base supply in the dark blue. Some of that's under contract. The green line shows the amount of that under contract. The amount above the green line is not yet under contract. But it shows the base supply, an incremental Cook Inlet 1, an additional supply that could be elicited, and then a second increment that could be elicited. The difference in those increments are their cost and the cost of supplies. As I said, it's not so much that we have a shortage of physical gas. We have a price issue. That's affecting it. Those supplies, additional supplies, could be attracted, but it would take a price. And the price is on that the analysts have looked at is the price that's reflected on that slide. I'll come back to that price in a little bit. But it's important, I think, for us to understand, at least it's important to me, that there's not a physical shortage of gas. There is gas out there. It's just simply, are we paying the right price to elicit that gas? Think of it in terms of the old supply demand curve. Are we paying enough to elicit the supply necessary to meet the demand? Instead, what I think what we're seeing is that the current price of gas is too low to elicit the needed supplies from existing sources. The price needs to rise to the level needed to attract additional supplies. And the market should be allowed to find the lowest overall cost of supply. These are lessons I think we learned in the lower 48 in the 1970s. We tried to keep a cap on price. We tried to essentially subsidize residential and small commercial homeowners in the interstate market by keeping a cap on price. And we saw a shortage because we didn't let the price rise to the level necessary to attract the additional supplies to meet that. Once we had the Natural Gas Policy Act of 1978, a major piece of legislation, we allowed the price to rise for gas supplies, and all of a sudden the shortage was over. Then we had a problem, frankly, of too high a price because of the way that Congress had constructed the act. But the shortage was over. The physical shortage was over. We found ways to, with the right price incentive, we found ways to develop the additional supplies. My second point is we shouldn't have any subsidies. The Cook Inlet gas issue should be resolved through the approach that has the lowest overall cost to all Alaskans. We all know Alaska is an expensive place to operate and live. Any decision we make should be to limit the overall costs to Alaska. I know some have focused on limiting the overall cost to people in the Cook Inlet region, people in South Central. How do we get the price down to them? But that's not the end of the story. If you get the price down to them by subsidizing the cost of gas in the Cook Inlet, all you're doing is you're squeezing that cost out someplace else. Subsidies don't eliminate costs. They only shift them to someone else. The overall cost to all Alaskans is the cost to the purchaser plus the cost of the subsidy. And I'll take a moment to talk about what I see as the lesson we learned in the early 20-teens from the Cook Inlet gas credits and the credits that we paid to the producers in the early 20-teens. We did keep the price of gas down. The producers got the credits. They produced additional supplies of gas at a price that NSTAR contracted with them for. But those credits came out of somebody's hide. Those credits, those subsidies came out of somebody's hide. In the moment, in the early 20-teens, they came out of the hide of the CBR, the SBR first, and then the CBR, in terms of draining down those. SBR is the statutory budget reserve. CBR is the constitutional budget reserve. And those credits came out of draining additional monies out of the SBR and out of the CBR. But frankly, I think those credits ultimately came at the expense of the PFD, because when we drained the SBR and the CBR, we had no cushion to back up paying a statutory PFD any longer. And so we started reducing the PFD. And what I think we experienced was we paid for those credits out of reduced PFDs, first reduced reserves in the early part, but now we're paying it out of reduced PFDs. That's what I mean when we need to look at the cost of the subsidies. If the subsidies are coming out of somebody's hide, and we need to pay attention to whose hide they're coming out of. We need to pay attention to what they are, how much they are, and then whose hide they're coming out of. Subsidies in one market also substantially distort adjacent markets. So, for example, if we subsidize the cost of gas and we brought the cost of gas down, just to pick a round number, $10, we brought the cost of gas down to $10. The market price, let's say, was $13. To elicit the additional supply, the market price was $13, but we brought the price down by subsidies to $10. Well, what we've done is we've damaged the adjacent markets of renewables and of weatherization, because we would have had some weatherization at $13. We would have had some investment in weatherization at $13. But by bringing the price of gas down to $10, we're not getting that weatherization. It's no longer economic to do that. We would have had some renewables at $13. It would have been better to invest in renewables than pay for gas at $13. That competition would have occurred, and we would have gone out and built some renewables. But by dropping the price of gas down to $10, those renewables didn't get built. Here's another problem with that. We tell ourselves we want weatherization, and we tell ourselves we want renewables, and we're willing to subsidize them. Well, we didn't have to subsidize them much at $13. Some weatherization would have occurred. Some renewables would have occurred at $13. But if we drop the price of gas down to $10, all of a sudden we're having to do deeper subsidies also for weatherization to get the amount of weatherization we want, because now we got to beat $10. And we also have to do additional subsidization for renewables to deal with that market.
Okay, so I was trying to kind of let Brad go get a flow here going, and then we'll. But there's going to be a lot of questions. So I guess Rep. McCabe, you were first.
So can we back up a little bit through the chair, Mr. Keithley? Slide 3. The very last 4 words or 5 words on that slide, how do we mitigate the impacts of that decision? That's the first question. What's the suggestion for mitigation?
I'm not sure you're going to like this.
That's okay.
So when I subsequently discussed this in a later slide, my point is that the who pays is likely the PFD. That if we're doing state subsidies, if we're either doing direct state subsidies or we're doing what I sometimes call backward state subsidies through royalty relief and through other ways of reducing costs, who ultimately pays that right now in the current setup is PFDs, because we don't have as much revenue to pay a PFD, or we have increased costs on other things, and so we don't have enough money to pay the PFD. It's the PFD that's taking the hit. It's the marginal source of revenue, if you will, into the state. That the PFD focuses the impact heavily, taking it out of the PFD, focuses the impact heavily on middle and lower income Alaska families. And so you're really saying that middle and lower income Alaska families ought to pay for the subsidies. It also says that middle and lower income Alaska families in Fairbanks, for example, ought to be paying heavily for the subsidies for the Cook Inlet. If it were me, this gets more into fiscal policy than maybe you want, but if it were me, I would look at broadening the base of who's going to be paying those subsidies in terms of broadening the base statewide or broadening the base locally, but in some fashion, not having it concentrated on middle and lower income Alaska families through PFD cuts. I would use the word taxes, but I'm afraid that would probably.
No, I think that and I guess I should tell the committee that, you know, I think that we should be open to all views in this committee, and that our ideas should be challenged. And so I wasn't necessarily fearful of having Brad come and present today. I wanted to have the dialogue, and I have a whole bunch of questions, but I'm going to hold off and let the follow-up. Rep. McCabe?
Yeah, thanks. Follow-up, and we're not afraid of that. We both sit on the Ways to Be Meaningful committee, so we've heard that T word before. Maybe you could take us down the path of why the cost of gas in Cook Inlet right now is not really a free market cost, why it is so low.
Through the chair. It's because NSTAR and Chugach are appropriately, they're utilities, they have an obligation to have lowest cost, but they're appropriately trying to hold the cost of gas down. It's in their interest because it maximizes demand. The lower the price, the higher the demand they have. But they're trying to keep the price of gas down. I think they're concerned a little bit about being second-guessed by the Utilities Commission if they pay a higher price. And I think they're concerned that they don't really, there's not a good price discovery mechanism in the Cook Inlet. And I'm sure there's some concern that they don't really know how to formulate that price. But I think it starts with the purchasers. I think the purchasers are saying, we want to keep the price of gas down. We want to keep it within the range that we've historically paid or are paying now. And we don't want to go above that. And we want to find other ways to get our supply other than additional price. And so we've got this standoff that's occurring between the purchasers and the sellers of the additional supplies.
So when you said the utilities, I think you meant the RCA?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
That's okay. Make sure.
I'm really old school. I go back to the old APC.
Yeah. And follow up, Brett McCabe.
Thanks. I have several questions, but one more for now. I'll probably be let everybody else to have their turn. But a certain amount of this is, well, there's a couple reasons, I think. First off, as you said, we're dealing with public utilities and you're dealing with the regulatory commission and all that. But a certain amount of it is that we sort of have a oligopoly of suppliers in the inlet, right? And I think that's what Hillcorp was telling us. There needs to be more suppliers. We need to get more suppliers at the meeting. When was that, in January, early January or late December?
The joint meeting, you mean?
No, the one in at the Denina Center, Mr. Serge.
November, I think.
Yeah. Anyways, that's what he was saying, was there needs to be more people. It just can't be Hillcorp. And it seemed to me he was saying that he was actually looking for competition because he didn't want to be blamed for this. I don't know. That seems kind of counterintuitive, but I think that all good businessmen, especially one that's not a publicly traded corporation, maybe are looking for the competition because they know that the free market sort of drives the natural stabilization, if you will, of price and supply.
I think that's fair. I think that's a good way of looking at it. But it's not just that. It takes price to elicit those additional suppliers. That's one of the lessons I think we learned in the 1970s in the lower 48. We had a bunch of incumbent suppliers. They were heavily regulated by then the Federal Power Commission, the FPC. In terms of price, and they were just sort of stuck in that paradigm. What the Gas Policy Act of 1978 did was free that up and say you can pay higher prices. And all of a sudden, we had a bunch of new players out there. I represented a bunch of them in my old days. We had a bunch of new players out there who came in and developed additional supplies, attracted by the higher price. So I think it's a combination of getting more players in there, but I don't think that's it alone. I think that we have to recognize that price has to go up to attract those additional players in there as well.
So Representative Sadler's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Keithley, I actually raised my finger initially because I wanted to just make the observation that in my experience, the state has invested fairly heavily in weatherization over the past decade. Yes, it is a lever you turn to reduce demand, and that's a good, smart thing to do, very high up in the supply chain. So that was one point. And the second point is that, I've got 3 points here, that you did hit on the clear point that decisions we make about high fiscal impact issues like gas supply, subsidies, transfer, et cetera, impinges on state finances, and the revenue from the permanent fund is, because that's a significant portion of our GF money, every decision we make impinges on the dividend, on the fund, and therefore the dividend. I know you carry some strong feelings and expressed at great length about those in other forums, so I just appreciate that. I would also, and though everything is connected, I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on gas supply and the price and factors. And the third point I'll make, and the final point, is that you said that market forces should help determine the price and the supply, et cetera, et cetera. And I would say that the demand that utilities, that the regulated RCA regulated utilities, is a important factor in those market prices. We shouldn't discount it entirely. But that's my view. So yep. I think we're going to have an interesting broad conversation philosophically and in details, but I'm looking forward to the conversation and throw that up for consideration.
If I can respond, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. Yes, I think the RCA ought to be part of this. I'm a little surprised they haven't been called before the committee yet, to tell you the truth. They have an obligation. The RCA has an obligation to ensure that their utilities meet their service obligations. Mm-hmm. And NSTAR is frankly telling you they can't. And Chugach is telling you that they're concerned they can't. They're concerned they're not going to have enough supply to meet their utility obligations. In other states, I've seen utility commissions light up at that sort of statement by utilities. They call them in for hearings. They have all sorts of procedures. They try to get at the bottom of what's going on. And they remind utilities that they have service obligations to have adequate supplies to meet their obligations. And want them to explain why they don't. And then lead them, as utility commissions tend to do, lead them toward a solution. I think the RCA has ample authority to be involved to that extent here. and I'm a little surprised they haven't been, and I'm a little surprised they haven't been called on the carpet for not taking that role. With respect to weatherization, yes, the state has invested heavily in it. I guess what I'm saying is I think we could invest a little bit less in it if we had market pricing on the gas supply in the Cook Inlet, because the economics would justify additional non-subsidized weatherization. In homes I've been in, I would have invested in additional weatherization if I had to pay NSTAR $15 as opposed to $8. It would have been economic for me to invest in additional weatherization. So I know the state has. I appreciate the state doing that. But what I'm saying is if we let the market operate, the state may not have to invest as much in that as it has in the past.
So, Mr. Keithley, I would like to make a couple points, if you wouldn't mind, and I don't want to sidetrack us too much, but this is a very, very important conversation. First of all, subsidies. You're correct. The oil tax credit program of past years was money straight out of the Treasury. No question about it. And I certainly can't argue that maybe PFDs were reduced as a result. The legislation that our office is working on these days avoids that. And what we've been trying to do is leverage gas and oil that's still in the ground that may never be produced and provide a tax holiday, so to speak, royalty holiday on that to incentivize our current operators in the inlet to drill and produce that stranded product that may never be produced. So we're not talking about taking money out of the Treasury. We're not talking about reducing PFDs. We're trying to get natural resource produced that may never see the light of day.
That's one point.
I guess so.
I don't mean to interrupt.
I mean, is that better? You know, Plan B is better than Plan A. You know, the royalties and the taxes to the Treasury are going to be less. But, again, the gas that gets left in the ground that never gets produced has no value to anybody.
So
how do you rationalize that, I guess?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. Let me give you my perspective on that. My perspective is that the market price, again, just to pick numbers, is, let's say, $12. Okay, or $11, or just, you know,
$8.60 right now, I think, is the number that NSTAR will tell you.
That's their embedded cost. That's their weighted average cost. Yes, sir. Let's just say the market price is $12. Okay. What we're doing with royalty relief is we're saying, yes, we know the market price is $12, but we don't want NSTAR to have to pay that. So what we're going to do is we're going to give you royalty relief so you can sell the gas at $10 and incentivize you by taking that cost off so you don't have to recover it in your contract. We're going to incentivize you by taking that burden off and letting you sell it at $10. That, to me, is as much a subsidy as a direct subsidy. Now, it turns into a subsidy because we don't get the revenues we otherwise would at $12. And so we shortfall the PFD as a consequence of that. But it's a subsidy to me. It is not as apparent a subsidy as a straightforward, here's a check from the state treasury. But it is nonetheless a subsidy because you're subsidizing what the market otherwise should be paying to elicit that additional supply by letting the producer off the hook of having to bear those costs.
So the response to that, Mr. Keithley, is that, yes, you're absolutely correct. That money is not going into the Treasury. PFDs are going to be lower. However, you're saving consumers perhaps millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars in increased rates in this closed market that we have. And again, this isn't an argument. I want to have a dialogue.
I appreciate this. My response to that is, yes, you're saving South Central consumers.
No, everyone.
Well, you're saving the GVEA. Okay, so you're saving GVEA and Fairbanks in that way also.
Fairbanks benefits from it, and the PCE is lower also. So everybody benefits.
But you're doing it by taking money out of the general fund, by not having money come into the general fund. And so you're doing it by affecting the PFD. You're doing it by lowering the revenue that would otherwise be there to help support a higher PFD. So you're subsidizing some consumers, South Central and through the GVEA, Intertie, Fairbanks,
PCE,
and through PCE broader,
which is most of the people in Alaska.
You're subsidizing some consumers, but you're doing it on the backs of others, on the backs of middle and lower income Alaska families through reduced PFDs.
Well, they may so their PFD goes down, but their power costs may go down even more.
So here's the analysis you get into with that. You have to look at it by income bracket, right? Yes, it will lower some people's costs of energy. It will lower everybody's. Let's take the assumption it'll lower everybody's cost of energy by some amount. It will lower some high consumers by more than small consumers. It will affect people differently. And you don't know until you do the analysis. You don't know if you're benefiting the same people you're hurting by reducing the PFD. I know who PFD cuts hurt. They hurt disproportionately middle and lower income Alaska families.
Yeah, I don't think we are debating that here. I mean, that's just common sense.
But you don't know if the benefit you're trying to give them by the subsidy of their energy costs is similarly tilted, is similarly disproportionate toward the same group.
Okay, the other point I wanted to make was renewables are subsidized also. We just had a presentation yesterday on all the tax credits and
yep.
So now let me. This is hard to describe. You're an expert. I'm not. Cook Inlet is a very, very mature, isolated, remote oil and gas basin. We basically have four operators out there. Hillcorp's the strongest, obviously, and then there's three others that are, you know, frankly struggling in some. For some different reasons, we don't see anybody else coming to help us. Even if the gas price went to 12 or 13, I'm not sure that there would be other companies that would just show up and help us. And the problem we have here, Brad, is this group and the people in this building. We can't be wrong. If we guess wrong or predict wrong or legislate wrong, it's really can be really bad for our constituents and everybody up here. So if we say we're not going to do anything, we're just going to let the market decide. Price goes up, people are paying more for their heat and their lights, and there's no increased drilling activity. But if that happens, it puts us farther behind, and I think creates a pretty bad situation. Am I making sense?
You are. You always make sense, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry.
Here's how that plays out. If we let LNG come in, or when LNG comes in, we've solved the supply situation. Period. We always have a backup supplier. There's never going to be another shortage, concern about shortage. The market will have responded by providing additional supplies. I think that helps the Cook Inlet. And there will be people who are surprised by that. But here's how I think it helps the Cook Inlet. You've reset the price at the market clearing price. You finally found somebody to have the supply. So you don't have to worry as much about always having supply there. And you've reset the price at the market clearing price. Then the Cook Inlet producers say, okay, well, the market clearing price is now 12. The market clearing price is no longer 8 or no longer 9 or no longer 10. I can now drill to 12. I mean, I can now look at 12 in my economics. And I think again, my experience in the lower 48 as we came out of the 1970s is people respond to that. They go, oh, wow, I don't have to sell it at the regulated price anymore, at the low price anymore. I can sell it at the higher price. And the great thing about LNG is it can be backed out. It's scalable. We have to build the kit, but we don't have to order the barges, or we don't have to order the tankers. So if we find a price response from the Cook Inlet, from Cook Inlet producers, we can just, you know, we can take that.
And don't order LNG that year.
Right. And I think it incentivizes, using market approaches, I think it incentivizes additional drilling in the Cook Inlet. And I don't know what we'll find. None of us know what we'll find. I mean, that was the thing that happened in the lower 48 in the 1970s. We didn't know what we would find. But we found that we developed a whole bunch of new producers. We've built a whole bunch of new technologies, a bunch of new thoughts about how to develop oil and gas, or gas in that case, and we solved the supply problem in that fashion by letting the market operate.
Now, so Mr. Keithley, so LNG's great. I agree. It gives you a second source, which you're not so dependent on one source. We don't get any taxes or royalties from LNG imported. So that's going to make PFDs go down.
It's not going to make them
go
down from what?
When you import LNG, you're displacing produced oil and gas from Cook Inlet that would provide money to the Treasury for PFDs. I'm sorry, I guess I'm trying to circle back on you.
No, I understand, and I greatly appreciate that. But my view on that is it doesn't back out Cook Inlet supply because of the higher price and because of the scalability of LNG. It doesn't back out Cook Inlet supply. It tells me as a producer, or tells John Hendricks, or tells whoever is a producer, my market price, my bogey now is $12 as opposed to. Or whatever the price is. My bogey is now 12. Just use 12. My bogey is now $12 instead of $8. And I can produce. I can do my economics now on $12. And if their economics work at that, then they can go to maybe $11.99 to give, you know, to incentivize NSTAR to buy from them. Yeah. Their economics work at that, they can go to NSTAR and say, I want to sell the gas to you. I have gas. I want to sell it to you. And NSTAR says, great, we'll just back out. We'll back out our next LNG cargo.
So a $9, let's just take some easy numbers. You keep saying 12. If we go from $9 to 12, that's a 33% increase, if I'm doing my math in my head correctly. So what you're suggesting, and I love the free market. If we could let the free market solve everything, it would be great. But that means everybody's... our electric and gas price is going to go up by 33%. And because we answer to the people, and I don't know if our constituents would be real happy with that.
Well,
if we just let that happen.
But they're going to have supply. I mean, what we're doing now is we're saying at $9, you get it at $9, but you don't get it. Always get it. At $12, you're always going to get it. And people are going to go to weatherization. They're going to go to alternatives, and say, "Look, I don't have to pay $12 on my full load like I had it at $9. I can invest in weatherization. I can reduce my load a little bit." Yes, prices are going to go. That's what the free market does. I mean, we had the same again. I don't mean to belabor the point, but the similarities are just sort of eye opening between what went on in the 1970s and the lower 48 and what's going on here. We had much higher prices in the lower 48 as a result of the deregulation under the Natural Gas Policy Act, and yes, people complained about it, but they found ways to conserve. They found maybe uses they had before weren't economic. They found weatherization. They found other alternatives and other ways of doing it. And producers found other ways of producing that. Look now, the price in the lower 48 right now is like $1.75 or $1.80, at least it was last week. I mean, they found more and more and more and more supply that gradually pushed the price down.
Okay.
So the market does, once you let it operate, it does it solves the problem in ways that maybe you couldn't imagine initially. Yes, there is a higher price to it. I agree. But my response to people in South Central would be, but we're going to have supply. And you can start dealing with you know, ways to reduce your demand yourself as a result of the price change. But we're going to have supply to meet your needs.
Okay, Representative Mears has a question. I'd like to kind of continue on with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to, I think we'll get on to the next slide with this one, too, if you don't mind, Mr. Keithley. So to the chair, I'm going to push back a little bit on if the base rates of natural gas increased by 33%. The utility rates won't be proportional because there's other costs that go into that. It'll be higher. But not quite a full pass-through on that.
It's simple.
But through the chair to Mr. Keithley, on the next slide, there's the graph on what's next for the pricing of Cook Inlet gas. And that the gas that we're getting now is, there's certainly a limited demand on that, but whatever's next is going to be another increment larger, and then there's another increment larger on that. And yeah. I think there's more slides further on in the presentation that show that as well. And so as we're getting into those higher increment costs for Cook Inlet gas, then they start becoming competitive with the imported LNG as well. And so if we're looking at two factors that would be raising, they're both raising the price of natural gas. We also need to start looking at the renewables and the cost of renewables being significantly lower. So it does make them more competitive, and that helps fill in that wedge there that we're not seeing supplied by Cook Inlet gas.
Yeah. Folk, if I may, Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
through the chair, Representative Mears, by focusing on this slide, you've reminded me that I need to focus on one thing, and that is, yes, if we start subsidizing the Cook Inlet to keep the prices down, if we say our target is, pick a number, $9, we're going to keep the price at $9. The subsidies are going to grow greater and greater over time because if you look at this slide,
yeah.
The first 4 years are filled with base supply. But beyond that, then the cost of the additional supply from the Cook Inlet is greater and greater. And to keep the price down, we're going to have to funnel in more subsidies to keep that price down. So the one of the other things, Mr. Chairman, I guess that I know you know, but I should point out, is that the price won't jump tomorrow from $9 to $12. We have a significant amount of the Cook Inlet still under contract at lower prices. And just like in the lower 48, again, in the 1970s, that will feather in the higher prices. It's the weighted average cost of all of your gas supplies.
Yeah.
So tomorrow it won't be $12. It'll be $9.10, and then it'll be down the road it'll be $9.20, $9.30. It'll gradually get there, but it will be more gentle than a price shock, and people will have the opportunity to take that into account.
Okay, why don't we continue so we can, but please make note of your questions and we'll get to them.
All right, I think we were on slide 5 because I'd spent a lot of time on slide 5. Actually, we'd been all the way through slide 5 because we talked about renewables and weatherization. All right, slide 6. What is the lowest overall cost? And this is a very, very, very important slide. These two slides are very important. They both come from the working group phase one assessment, and they're excellent slides in terms of looking at the overall costs. And I've looked at the numbers, and they seem to have been developed very rigorously, and so I have a lot of faith in them. The cost of gas, of the Cook Inlet gas, the number one on the left-hand side, the number one supply opportunity or the number one supply alternative, cost of gas goes from $9.30 to $25.5. And when I initially saw that slide, I couldn't figure out what was going on until I read the next slide over and figured out what was going on. The next slide over shows where that range is coming from. The base supply that we currently have under contract or otherwise is is accessible through existing kit that we have out there, is lower cost. But as we go on, we have to pay more to elicit or subsidize more to elicit the additional supply. The 9 to 19 only gets us 3 more years of full requirements. Then we have to kick over into the 15 to 26 to get 3 more years of additional requirements after that, full requirements after that. To meet the, and by full requirements, I mean the line at the top, which is the 70 BCF, which we describe as the size of the Cook Inlet market. NSTAR plus Chugach plus whoever else uses gas. And then we get 3 more. And then we're out of the 15 to 26, and we have supply shortages again starting in 2034, and the price of that's going to be even higher. Compared to, let me go to the next slide. Again, the $9.30 and the 25.5. And then these are the range of the other opportunities, some of which are subsidized, some of which are not subsidized. And this slide, hopefully, if I did the right one. No? Yep. Well, let me cut to the chase on this point, and then I'll cut back to the others. This slide takes those alternatives, looks at the low of the alternative, the low price of the alternative, the high price of the alternative, and just calculates the midpoint. And it shows, and this is from the Cook Inlet assessment, the non-subsidized alternatives. It shows that LNG actually comes out over time the lowest cost of the alternatives.
Is that, just to be clear, the Kenai LNG in the top line, that's important?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so is the FSRU, which is the floating storage and regas unit, and the Greenfield port and regas. All of those are LNG. But it shows that those costs of supply over time are lower than the cost of the Cook Inlet gas supply. So not only are we solving the long, again, to go back to this previous slide, not only are we solving the long-term gap that we had, we're solving it at a lower price than we're going to end up solving it if we keep focusing on Cook Inlet gas. A lower price, either in terms of just the price that buyers pay, or the subsidies, if we go down the subsidy route, a lower subsidy that we're going to have to that the state's going to have to pay to keep it. So this assessment of the various alternatives tells you a lot. It tells you that Cook Inlet gas at the current price level isn't a long-term solution. It tells you that Cook Inlet gas, even at higher prices, isn't a long-term solution. That after 32, we start running out of, we need additional gas supplies beyond that. And it tells you the cost of the alternative supplies, and in doing so tells you that the cost of LNG is lower long-term than those alternative sources.
Now, NSTAR told us imported LNG, I think they quoted us $16. But I'm not going to dispute
yep.
who's right or who's wrong. That's another data point we have, 16, which is approaching double what we're paying right now. But I don't know if that's right or not, but that's what we got from NSTAR.
That's fair enough. This is the overall assessment. I have faith in the rigor of the numbers.
Yeah.
And if you have questions about these numbers, I would call in the economists that did these numbers.
Yeah.
And question them on those numbers. But even at 16, Mr. Chairman, even at 16, that price is lower than the upper range of the next tranche, the light blue tranche on the slide that's up, and significantly lower than the midpoint of the gold tranche that's up. And it's a supply that continues past 2032. It's not a supply that starts running you into the same problem in 2032.
Representative Sadler had a question.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Mr. Keithley, slide 7, looking at that, I've read the Berkeley Group report, and I largely just want the same conclusions you are, but I just want to probe a few numbers on this chart. Look at the line, option 3, Kenai LNG. The ending price of supply is between 12 and 13.6 per million cubic feet. But the CapEx is only 768 If you look above that and the in-state pipeline, yeah, the price of supply is between $7 and $10 per MCF. But the CapEx is $8.8 billion. So my question, is there a weighted cost of supply that includes all the capital expenditure to get to that point? Because the pipeline is not going to happen unless we put a whole bunch of money on the table.
Yeah. So look at 2C, state-owned. And what that's essentially saying is the state's going to take a hit. The state's not going to earn a return on the investment. It's going to subsidize it through state-owned, through being state-owned. It's going to be, with all due respect, Mr. Chairman, it's going to be like a highway. We're not going to charge for the cost of building it. If you look, Representative Sadler, through the chair, if you look at 2A, in-state pipeline private, that, and then look at the CapEx numbers are exactly the same, that's the cost. That's the unsubsidized cost. So the cost of the subsidy that we're talking about is the difference between that private cost and the state-owned cost. Mm-hmm. If we only subsidize at 80%, then you can see the price level on 2B. But that's what's going on.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue, Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right, I wanted to hit on this. This is one of the slides from the presentation that Trevor and Ed did for the committee, because I think it's another way of really demonstrating what's going on here. We get a certain amount of supply at $8 to $10 because we're just producing off operating costs. We're not having to drill any additional well, any significant additional wells, not do any technology, not doing extended reach, not putting in any new, I want to say tripod, not any new.
Jacob?
Thank you, Riggs. I knew a drilling engineer would get
it. I tried it. I'm trying to stay with you, Brad.
but I mean, we get a certain tranche of supply, and then we have to pay $11.16 for additional supply on top the next tranche of supply on top of that, and then $17 to $25 for the next tranche and $25 and beyond. That slide to me is exactly the same thing as this slide. It's telling you in a different way, in a much more colorful way, and in a much more perhaps understandable way, what's going on. But it's telling you that you have to pay more for additional supplies. And again, it's not that we have a shortage of supply. It's that we're not paying the price necessary to elicit that additional supply.
I guess if I could offer you call it an anecdotal story. I remember when I came into the oil industry in the 80s, it seemed like $18 a barrel was sort of the go, no-go threshold for investment. And then it seemed like in the 90s and the early 2000s, it became like $32 a barrel was sort of the where projects would go or not go. And now I think we're, at least in Alaska, I think we're in the 50. I see Carolyn nodding her head back there. Okay. It seems like nowadays in Alaska, at least, projects go if oil prices are above 50, if oil prices go below 50. So it's kind of the same way with natural gas.
Yep.
You have these, I don't know, I guess you call it market point. Is it market point you call it?
Yeah.
Price point that it's like a stair step. It's not a curve. And so
we have to incur more costs. I mean, we have to incur more costs. There's a heck of a lot more costs incurred in Willow than for example, in developing Willow than there would be in the Prudhoe satellite fields, because you have to put more kit out there. You've got more expense that you've got to run. You've got to do a bunch of construction. It's the same thing that's going on. It's going on the gas side. And you can't fight that. If you try to fight it through subsidies, what you end up is with you end up with shortages, because you can't outguess the market. The government can't outguess the my opinion. The government can't outguess the market. We can say we know what it should be, but the market will determine what it is, and that's a whole lot of factors going in: supply costs, moving rigs up here, cost of people, cost of food. I mean, it's a whole bunch of different things.
Yeah.
But the market will adjust to what the price needs to be to develop the additional supply.
So, Representative McCabe.
So maybe I can, put some common language into this. So I think what we're trying to get to is the same thing. We're just doing it two different ways. You're saying there's a price point at which people will come in and develop the gas, the natural gas in the inlet, if the price point goes up. And what we're saying is, and we're recognizing that there's an artificial cap on the price right now. We're saying that we don't want to remove that cap. We're not saying it, but this, the other way is not to remove that cap and just subsidize people to come in and develop it anyway. So the goal is the same. It's just the approach to getting there. You're advocating for the free market to take effect and just remove the artificial cap we have, let the price go up to where it is, which costs the people in increased power costs. And we're saying use subsidies, which cost the people in lower PFDs and in a CBR that's approaching zero and a budget that's going to struggle every year. So
I think that, through the chair, I think that's an excellent way of putting it. I would add a couple more things to it. One is the subsidies grow larger because if you're trying to say it's always going to be $9 and you're looking at a chart like this,
yeah,
that says you got a stair step, you produce more with more cost, the subsidies are going to grow larger. And the second thing I think is there may be a point where the price, there isn't a high enough price. If you look at this chart prepared by the Cook Inlet Utilities Assessment Group, you see past 2020, 2032, we've got a gap there. There's no price, no increment, and no price. What LNG does for you, and I'm not pushing LNG, I'm just saying that's what the market's telling you.
Yeah.
What LNG does for you is it fills that gap. And it fills it at a fairly moderate price compared to these prices, compared to these increments. And it fills it long term. You have the supply. You're not running the risk of no supply, and you're filling it at a price point that is less. You know, yes, we can continue to subsidize. We can continue to try to keep the price down, but that system will break down at some point. It'll either break down in terms of being too expensive, or it will break down in terms of it just isn't going to incentivize enough.
Follow-up, Rep. McCabe.
Follow-up through the chair. So, Mr. Keith, yeah, I mean, it'll break down. It's already breaking down in the shrinking CBR and in the shrinking PFD because we have, artificially capped it. But I would be remiss. You just said something that sort of triggered me if I didn't mention that we wouldn't be necessarily having this discussion if we had a coal-burning power plant that relied on the cleanest coal on the planet from Healy, Alaska, my district. We should have, I mean, we're talking about natural gas, and then we're talking about subsidies. Subsidies are not going to replace natural gas. We should be doing an all-in approach. We should have not relied on one thing like we have been doing for the last two decades, which is natural gas. And now we're scrambling to put something in, renewables, wind, solar. And I think what's going to happen, since we have so much of it, is we are going to go back to coal.
Yep, go ahead. Respond, please, Mr. Keithley.
Through the chair. This chart on slide 7, this chart talks about gas supply opportunities, and so it's focused on gas. It's focused on some esoteric gas. RNG and hydrogen are sort of out there at the margins. But a full chart would have coal. And it would be part of the look. Now, I'm not saying coal would be cheap. I mean, the permitting costs, the scrubbing costs, all of those costs would be significant, and it might end up being an expensive source of supply. But a good assessment would look at the potential of replacing gas with coal.
Okay, Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to add into the discussion here, looking at coal or renewables or anything that would generate more electricity would also require a change in our infrastructure, South Central, because we're very much set up for natural gas weather, no matter where it comes from. The appliances we have in our house is a big part of that. So it's something that it's a transitionary, no matter what the source of electricity is.
Correct. Please continue, Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'm on slide 10. And that is the slide that tries to take the full assessment group analysis and boil it down. This is looking at the non-subsidized costs or the non-subsidized alternatives. I will say, and I need to recognize that there is one alternative that's cheaper than Kenai LNG, and that is the one that's at the bottom that I added at the bottom, Alaska LNG, the Alaska LNG project at full volumes. Now, by full volumes, I mean we have an export contract, we're filling up a 40-inch line, and the unit costs are way down. This is the working group's assessment of that cost at full volumes. But we're not at full volumes. We don't have the commitments now that would put it at full volumes. And so that, I put it down there because it is an alternative. It is a lower price. But I guess we have to put these through a reality test as well.
It'd be what I would call the silver bullet.
Well put. All right. And one other thing, Representative Sadler raised the point. I just want to point out that I've got it on here. The in-state pipeline, a private pipeline, a non-subsidized pipeline I've got on there at the 32.6. I tried to gather all of the various non-subsidized alternatives and put them in one place and rank them by cost. This is a point I made earlier, but I think it bears repeating, that the study, both the study that the assessment group did and the study that Trevor and Ed put together, also suggests that LNG won't fully displace Cook Inlet gas. I mean, we're not out of Cook Inlet gas yet. To go back a couple of slides to this slide, slide 8, it shows the dark blue, which is from existing, essentially from the existing basin or existing supplies, ramping down over time, not disappearing, but ramping down over time. Any LNG option has to take that into account because presumably that base supply will be at a lower cost. And again, it has the benefit of blending in at that lower cost and lowering the overall weighted average cost of gas. But also, I think we have, this slide has 9 to 19 and 15 to 26 on it. People, when they have a higher price to target, sometimes they find a way to, you know, pencil down what they otherwise think might be a higher number. And if we have LNG in at 12 to 15 or 16 or whatever it is, I think producers are going to assess and find opportunities that they haven't found out there at $8. And we'll see that supply come in. And again, the advantage of LNG over some of the other alternatives is it's scalable. We have to build the kit. We have to build the receiving kit, but we don't have to take the barges.
So I'm excited about your conclusion that by importing LNG could actually help Cook Inlet.
Yes.
Because, you know, we're politicians. We're not engineers or economists anymore. We're politicians, and that means we answer to, you know, 18,000 people on average per district. Nobody in here is actually from the Kenai, but, you know, Representative Vance, Representative Carpenter, Representative Ruffridge, there's a lot of people that work in the oil and gas industry on the Kenai Peninsula. They love those jobs because they don't have to go to the slope. And I would hate to take an action that would sort of destroy that socioeconomic, what do you want to call it, the Kenai Peninsula oil industry that's been so wonderful for us since the 60s, even 50s. So maybe you could comment, you know, we want to keep that going, I think, as politicians. And I'm happy to see you concluded that LNG imports could actually help make that area prosperous.
I'll try another analogy.
Did I
I'll try another.
Right?
Yeah, yes, sir. I'll try another analogy from the 70s. So there was a category of gas in the Natural Gas Policy Act called high cost gas, and it was set at $7 and then escalated from there. And it was sort of viewed as a necessary additional supply that was needed in order to avoid the supply curtailments that we were having at the time. That we had to pay that much in order to put it in scale. I think the highest regulated price at the time was like $1.25 or something of that nature. So we had that additional supply, and the thought was at the time we were going to need all that we could get in order to fill the supply gap that we saw coming. What happened was it very quickly went out of business. That category of gas very quickly went out of business because people said, "Oh, I can sell it at $6.99 or I can sell it at $6.50." And yeah, you know, I can't produce a lot. I can't make the economics work at $1.25, but I can make the economics work at $6.50, and I can undercut the heck out of that high cost gas. And we had a renaissance. We had an explosion of additional development and production in the lower 48 over the next 20, 30 years. That's now turned into tight gas. That's kept it even going even longer. We had an explosion of those alternatives. People saw that sort of set a marker price. That was the market price. And I can undercut that and I develop additional supplies. That's what I think the potential is for Cook Inlet. Now, Cook Inlet, you're correct in that it's an isolated basin. It's sort of confined. You don't find a bunch of additional things that you can bring in on it. But I think going to a market price saying this, we're going to let the Cook Inlet operate according to the market. And we're going to have a backup. We're going to have the kit in for LNG to make sure we don't have a supply shortage. But we're going to let it go to the market. I think we're going to see opportunities. We're certainly going to see the continuation of the base gas that we've got because that's going to be at lower price. And a lot of it's already under contract. But I think we're going to see opportunities of additional supplies. People will go out and be creative and think about ways that they can get additional supplies once we let the market operate at a market price.
Okay, please continue, Mr. Keithley.
Mr. Chair.
Rep. Sadler.
Thank you. If we're done with slide 11, I want to comment briefly on slide 12, if I may.
Yep.
Yeah, through the chair. Mr. Chair, I sincerely appreciate the discussion about natural gas issues and supply and price and so forth. But frankly, looking ahead to the slideshow, I'm not really sure where this slide fits into that presentation. This slide makes the presumption that there will be subsidies and that will be a solution to our energy issues. It presumes that the subsidies would come from the permanent fund, and there are other options, not necessarily. And it goes deep into identifying which demographic or income sections of Alaska society would pay that. Certainly Mr. Keithley has clear ideas. He expresses them forcefully and repeatedly, but I'm not sure if that's a decision. Well, that's a policy decision for us to consider. And certainly who pays is an important consideration. But as you said before, there are other considerations as well. The reliability of supply, the effect on the economy, the effect on people's lives, as well as, not exclusive of, but as well as the amount of permanent fund dividends. So I think to focus specifically on that, maybe just a little bit too much emphasis on one aspect, I'll just say that. Certainly glad to see the slide, but just want to make sure I get that on there.
Yeah, I think we, Mr. Keith, I think we all really understand about the PFD situation and how this in the building. We definitely know.
I can spend about 3 hours talking about it, Mr. Sherman.
I know. I'm not trying to control your, but please continue. We'll try to get done and then we can ask some more questions.
Well, taking that into account, I appreciate the point Representative Sadler raises. I will say that that this bullet point starts off with if the state does use subsidies. I'm not assuming the state will use subsidies, but I do want to get, since subsidies have been discussed, I do want to get the point out there that if the state does use subsidies, somebody's going to pay them.
Yeah.
And the marginal source of revenue that we've used in this state over the last 7 years has been PFD cuts. Could be. We may find a different way to do it. But the marginal source of revenue we have used over the last 7 years is PFD cuts. And PFD cuts do affect middle and lower income Alaska families disproportionately. Everybody can say it with me, right?
By I'm going to say it.
Do affect middle and lower income Alaska families disproportionately. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to have subsidies, if we're going to have subsidies, then we should worry about who's going to pay that subsidy because somebody is. And we should worry about whether it's the right set of people that we have paying it. And, Mr. Chairman, you raise a good point about, well, yes, but they're going to have some lower utility costs. We should look at that. Who's going to have the benefit of that lower utility cost? And if it lays on top of the same group that's taking the hit of the PFD cuts, and they have greater benefits in terms of utility cuts than they do, or lower utility prices than they do in terms of PFD cuts, then that's a great analysis to have. I've not seen anybody do that analysis. Maybe I should, but that's a great analysis.
And do it at no charge, right?
For no charge and talk about it for days. But if we're going to have subsidies, if we're going to have subsidies,
yeah,
we should worry about who's going to bear the burden of those subsidies. And we should worry about whether that's a fair allocation of the burden of those subsidies. That's the only point.
Yep. We got it.
Of that slide.
Representative McCabe.
So, thanks through the chair, Mr. Keithley. Prior to Governor Walker cutting the PFD and the Welikowski case, we wouldn't be having this discussion because the cost for the subsidies and the cost to Alaskans would be coming out of our CBR, or we would be more focused on making budget cuts so that we could maintain the savings in our CBR as we're supposed to, right?
And you'd be paying the full statutory PFD.
You're just saying it's coming out of the PFD because that's the absolute last tranche of money, essentially, that we have left to pay.
That you have under your direct control.
Right.
I could use the T word about it as being another source of revenue, perhaps a broad-based, more fair source of revenue. But I'm skating on very thin ice if I keep going down that.
No, we understand all that, Brad. We really do, yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So a word about royalty relief. We've already actually been through this, I don't mean to be redundant. I'll just make the point that royalty relief is a subsidy. It transfers to the producer the revenue the state otherwise would receive from the resource when sold. Producer may decide to pass it on to the buyer by saying, I'm only going to charge you $8. Now that I got $4 off my costs, I can only charge you $8. To me, when I first heard about this issue, I thought, well, we've already got royalty relief. And I've gone in and looked at the statutes.
Yeah, we do.
And there's a lot of authority at DNR to provide for royalty relief. I like it, frankly, because of the third bullet point. It requires that any relief be targeted. It says the commissioner shall, this is one of those cases I think shall has meaning, shall provide for an increase or decrease or other modification of the state's royalty share by a sliding scale royalty or other mechanism that shall be based on the change in the price of oil and gas or may also be based on other relevant factors. It targets, the benefit of that provision is it targets the royalty relief at a situation where you really have to have it in order to physically get the supply, attract the physical supply. If we don't have something like Kenai LNG, if we don't have a backup, then we may be talking a lot about this provision because we may have to go in and target a lot of supply, but it's all going to be subsidies. It's all going to be benefiting certain producers and certain buyers at the expense of state's revenue as a whole.
Well, and we're told, I think the latest information was 2030. What's that? 6 years from now, before they'd be ready to take the first load of imported LNG. I think that's the year that I've heard most recently.
And this shows, I'm back on slide 8 for a moment, which to me is sort of a touchstone slide. This shows that before we get to 2030, we've got a need for certainly additional supplies above the contracted supply, as well as these light blue bars start showing up in 2027, we have a need for an additional tranche. That may be a situation, frankly, Mr. Chairman, where we need royalty relief physically to get additional supplies on. But my point is it should be targeted and focused on getting those additional supplies on for that period of time until we can get LNG up. And it may come at much higher subsidies. It may come at much higher prices to get them on. But we have, I guess my perspective on it when I first heard about this was we've got royalty relief statutes on the books.
Yes.
That gives DNR the authority to go out and do that.
I think that our thinking on it was that if you have a change in administration, that those royalty relief measures made by a commissioner can be reversed. And we thought that in legislation, it's much more lasting and harder to change and would be more of an incentive because the investor would know that there would be stability. That was what's in our minds.
If I can comment on that, Mr.
Sure.
Chairman. Yes, but it also would extend the subsidies into a period where you otherwise might not need them. It might extend it significantly past 2030. I mean, if you have a bunch of producers that come in and take that royalty relief, and it's for the life of the field,
and as you probably know, gas wells decline.
Yep.
And you actually need more help, more economic help to make the well economic as it fades, as the production goes down. So there really never comes a day when a gas well suddenly starts producing more. You know, they all just decline and eventually die out. So they become less and less economic every year that goes by.
Yeah.
Representative McCabe.
So on this slide, where you said it also requires, actually in 2019, the Supreme Court changed the meaning on us of the word shall. Apparently doesn't mean shall anymore. It means may. You have to have must in there. So I wonder how that would play out in this particular statute.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I don't know. I will go back and think about that, and will supplement my comments on that issue. I understand about being concerned about a change in administrations, but any administration is going to want to make sure that we have adequate supply. I mean, I can't see a governor that we elect a governor who's going to say, oh, no, let's run Cook Inlet short.
Yeah.
Maybe if we elect somebody from Fairbanks and they have a grudge against Anchorage, I'd beat them. But
yes, except Maxine.
Or somebody from Kotzebue that has a grudge against Anchorage. I doubt if we're going to have a governor who's you're going to have a grudge against Anchorage. Eagle River's going to have a grudge against Anchorage. I doubt if we're going to have a governor who does that. So I appreciate the point. I'm not as concerned about it.
Representative Mears' question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be for you and other members of the committee. It was my understanding that once a royalty rate is set within a lease, it can't go up. It can go down, but it can't go up again. So if we have got a lease that's got a royalty relief on there, it's not going to get larger. Am I recalling that correctly?
Well, the state royalty is 12.5%. So that's where you start at. And then, yeah, you're right. You can't go above 12.5. You can go below.
Yeah.
The DNR commissioner can do it.
So if we've got a lease that we've
but got I guess, really well, I guess the other thing was, to be honest, hypothetically, our current DNR commissioner may not want to do this, but the legislature might want to. So we sort of like overrule that. That's a possibility where maybe the legislature says we want to be more aggressive. And that's why we've been talking about it in the legislative realm.
That's fair. I guess if I can respond to Representative Mears, also her point as well, if that's acceptable. This provision would allow the royalty to go down when needed, come back up. So it wouldn't exceed the contractual provision of 12.5, but it could come back up under certain circumstances. The great thing about this, maybe not if you have a DNR commissioner who doesn't want to do it, but the great thing about this is it's targeted.
Yeah.
And it will allow the DNR commissioner or any legislation you do may want to be targeted as well in a similar way to focus on situations where we're going to have physical shortages, a gap, if you will, in the physical supply. and elicit the additional supply necessary to get you past that point. But not to be wholesale in a way that would then continue those subsidies for a number of years in the future.
And just to address that, we've been talking about, you know, there's gas at Kitchen Lights.
Yep.
And there's gas at Cosmopolitan, which is operated by Bluecrest. And we've been talking to both of those operators about what we could do to target royalty relief help to help those operators get more gas production going, like, you know, soon, this year or next year, to fill in that gap until LNG imports are possible, which is, like I said earlier, 2030. And they both have unique problems and challenges, but we're not talking about royalty relief for the whole state. The North Slope is a completely different topic. And Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on slide 13, I really appreciate this, Greshmer having to have what's sometimes a technical but sometimes also philosophical discussion. So I just want to address the first bullet point about royalty relief. Does indeed transfer to the producers some money? Is it foregone revenue? Is it revenue? But I will observe that a subsidy would also transfer to the public value in the form of heat, light, power, economic stability, and so forth. So I guess that would be kind of my philosophical point, that if we look at this solely with a green eye shade, we might miss other important factors.
That's the difference between economist and politician. I have to keep saying that.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't disagree that there are other factors involved, and I think you've raised a very good point about the other factors. The question is matching the beneficiaries of those factors with who's bearing the cost of the subsidies. We've not been very good about that, to be very honest, and I think it's something that the state should get better at. And if we're going to open up another area of subsidies, even if it may be limited, and even if it may be time limited and volume limited, and we put very tight constraints around it, we need to consider who's paying those subsidies, and we need to consider whether there's a mismatch between the benefits that Representative Sadler and others have talked about and who's paying the cost of those subsidies.
Okay, let's finish up. Mr. Keithley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The summary slide is just to reiterate the points. My experience and my work life has indicated that we should let the market decide the outcome based on the lowest overall cost. The market appears to suggest LNG, and I think we need to take that into account. And the cost of any subsidies, if any, designed to achieve a different outcome should be calculated and added to the different outcome to transparently determine its overall cost. If needed for a specific objective, should be strictly limited in time and scope. Recognize it will affect adjacent markets, potentially increasing the cost of weatherization and of renewables, and even of coal, if we want to go down coal, because subsidies will lower the cost of gas, and that will make coal less economic than it otherwise might be if we had gas at market prices. And will be borne, the subsidies will be borne, if we have subsidies, they will be borne by some set of Alaskans. To minimize the impact, the cost of any subsidies should be spread broadly, not concentrated on middle and lower income Alaska families, or not concentrated on any group of Alaska families. That's the presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Mr. Keithley very much. I think we've had a lot to think about and talk about. I would say that Mr. Keithley has a way of presenting complex economic information in a way that at least I can understand more readily. And I think you have a knack for kind of presenting it in a, not such a theoretical, difficult way to comprehend. So keep it simple. Representative Sadler,
question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. I just want to say in a wrap-up, too, I appreciate Mr. Keithley being here. I'll echo what you said. I appreciate the chance to have a discussion that's informed a lot of facts and a lot of perspective, a lot of hard-won experience in this industry. I think he does raise some very important parameters in the discussion. I'm not saying they should be the only ones, but this has been a valuable conversation as we address the big energy issues and the big fiscal issues facing our state. So I appreciate the presentation.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for inviting Mr. Keithley. Mr. Keithley, thank you so much for being here. I think it really clarifies a lot of things, having another perspective. And to me, also highlights that we need to have, I think, a better handle on what potential utility rate increases there might be. Perhaps that's through discussion with the RCA or other means in here. And I also wanted to say thank you for reminding me that the current DNR royalty relief program is a negotiation, that maybe the royalty rate is lower and then increases over time. But it doesn't unilaterally change upwards. It's part of that negotiation. So thank you very much for the discussion.
So the takeaways for me is we need to have a presentation by RCA, and we have had them on our list. I'd have to check with my staff to see if we've got them actually scheduled. And it looks like I need to go talk to oil companies and say, well, will you come drill in Cook Inlet at $12 an MCF, $15 an MCF, and see if there's interest. And like I said, we're politicians. We're not economists. So sometimes we have to take some other factors into account, and jobs and the economy. And that's, I guess, why we get paid the big bucks. So with that, any closing comments, closing thoughts, Brad?
Okay. No, Mr. Chairman, just to thank you for the opportunity to present, and I appreciate that you're taking different viewpoints, and that's a very good thing. Thank you for the time.
All right, with that, then, that concludes our presentation. Thanks, Mr. Keithley, for being here. I hope we have a continuing dialogue as we move through these difficult times, and we'll close for today. Our next meeting may not be Monday. The joint session, the first word I had was Monday at 1:30. Then I've heard Monday at 2:15. So I'm not sure we'll even try to have resources on Monday, because everybody's going to be very emotional, and it's going to be a real fluid situation. So we probably might not want to have a meeting kind of collide with that. So we'll let you know. But I don't think we'll have a meeting on Monday, I'm pretty sure. So with that, I will adjourn us at 2:30 p.m. Thank you.